Today on the John Ankerberg Show, what about five controversial new books about Jesus that have been featured in specials on NBC, ABC, and the National Geographic Channel? You know about the Da Vinci Code movie and book. We'll include that in our discussion. But what about the Jesus Papers by Michael Bagent and the Gospel of Judas? Is there new information about Judas that we didn't know? Is Michael Bagent correct in asserting Jesus didn't die on the cross? That it was the greatest cover-up in history? What evidence does he present? Finally, what about the claims made in the Jesus Dynasty by James Tabor and Misquoting Jesus by Bart Ehrman? To answer these questions and expose the historical errors in these books, my guests are Dr. Craig Evans, professor of New Testament at Acadia Divinity College in Nova Scotia. Dr. Evans was selected as a member of the National Geographic Dream Team of Scholars and asked to examine the Gospel of Judas. He appeared in the two-hour National Geographic special and also appeared in the NBC special regarding the Jesus Papers. My second guest is Dr. Gary Habermas, professor and chairman of the Department of Philosophy and Theology at Liberty University. He is acknowledged as one of the leading scholars in the world on the resurrection. We invite you to join us today to find out the truth about these new controversial books. Welcome to our program. We're talking with two of the best, and Dr. Craig Evans from Acadia Divinity College and Dr. Gary Habermas from Liberty University. We're talking about five best-selling books that have all come out. They're all attached to some of the television specials of NBC, ABC, National Geographic, and we want to help you with the information that you're receiving. What is the difference between the facts and the buzz that is taking place with these books? And today we've got two of the best, Dr. Craig Evans, who was one of the main scholars that was asked by National Geographic to look at the Gospel of Judas. He was called a super sleuth on ancient manuscripts, part of the dream team they put together. And then we also have Dr. Gary Habermas, one of the leading scholars in the world on Jesus' resurrection. And guys, I'm really glad that you're here today. And Craig, let's start with you. The fact is, you've talked about when you examine documents, you got phony documents, you got good documents. You've got real documents that are late, and you got real documents that are early, and there's a big difference in terms of how you interpret that stuff. And you've got archaeological finds that are uncertain, some that are certain, but you don't know how to place them in the historical context. Start us anywhere you want. You were one of the scholars that was picked by National Geographic to examine this new book or this new gospel that was found, the Gospel of Judas. Tell us when it was found, when it was dated, and what's the main message.
The Gospel of Judas has sparked a lot of debate and a lot of misunderstanding. So I'm glad to be able to speak to that. A codex was discovered in an uncertain location in Egypt about 30 years ago. It went through a very long and circuitous history of trying to be sold and hidden away, and unfortunately not well cared for. And so it deteriorated and was in very poor condition. A few years ago, it finally fell into the hands of competent scientists and researchers, and the text has been partially restored. Some pages are still missing. Well, the scientific testing has indicated that this codex, written in the Coptic language, which, by the way, is Egyptian, using the Greek alphabet, this codex dates to right around 300. There is no question about it. Analysis of the ink, carbon-14 testing of the papyrus itself, it dates to 300. The codex that we have has 66 pages. In those 66 pages are four documents. One of them, the longest, is the Gospel of Judas. The contents of this Gospel agree with the description that the church father Irenaeus wrote down in his Against Heresies dating to the year 180, where he describes a Gospel of Judas in which Judas is the best of the disciples and actually does what Jesus tells him, which is to hand him over to his enemies for his death. That's what the Gospel of Judas says. And so we infer then that from the data that the original Gospel of Judas was written in Greek probably in the year 150 or 160. That is true. It's a real document. However, I think we need to understand that this mid-second century story, this Gospel of Judas, is not a genuine reflection of the historical Jesus and the historical Judas Iscariot. It's an interesting document. It tells us things about second century diversity in Christian thought, heresy, Gnosticism, and so on, but it does not tell us anything about the actual historical Jesus and Judas. That's where we need to be very clear.
Yeah, I think people need to realize it would be like somebody today in our time writing about Abraham Lincoln. Okay, so if you go back to Lincoln around 1850, and we're in 2006, this is approximately where the Gospel of Judas was written. So anything that somebody would say about a person 100, 150 years ago is not going to be a true historical account. Now, it doesn't even claim that, does it?
No, what it claims to be is a secret revelation, a private teaching between Jesus and Judas. And the interest is very much on the act of betrayal and showing that it wasn't really betrayal at all. It was an act of obedience. So it's a fanciful tale. And the reading public and certainly Christians need to understand that the Gospel of Judas most certainly does not overturn the Gospel story that we have in the New Testament.
Gary, there's another one that has come out. It's called The Jesus Dynasty by James Tabor. This is a fellow that's an archaeologist, University of North Carolina, works with Bart Ehrman there, and the fact is he's got a very interesting book about Jesus and the Jesus Dynasty. Gary, tell us about this.
Well, unlike some of the other things that are coming out right now, James Tabor is a scholar. He's a University of Chicago grad, department head at UNC Charlotte. And this book is an interesting mixture of archaeology, exegetical work, some sociological distinctions, traveling here and there, putting pieces together, and almost like a sleuth, you know, you're going to be taken through this book to different settings. I think some of the major claims in this book that are going to hit the TV and radio waves are that, first of all, he is going to separate the early Christian tradition from a James and Mary, basically family of Jesus tradition that goes this way. And then later, the other divergence is Paul. Now, Paul writes so many things in the New Testament, is so influential, and makes his way around so much of the Mediterranean world. He actually becomes the more influential of the two, and Paul's tradition kind of slams the door on the James, Mary, Jesus family tradition.
Yeah, in Jesus' dynasty, the fact is that he didn't say that he was God. You want to erect this dynasty, and he passes the baton to James.
Right. It's almost a genetic dynasty, hence the title of the book.
Now, he's sure that Jesus died.
Absolutely.
So he contradicts some of the other books we're going to talk about, but he's sure that Jesus died.
Right.
But then he says that the body was moved by, and then he speculates who it was. He says, comes back to the mother of Jesus.
Mary and some of the other ladies in particular moved the body. And what gets them past Holy Saturday, so to speak, this day of despair and despondency, and we thought he was the one who would save us from the Romans kind of view, is this rah-rah, rally the troops, and the bloodline that he passes on. And then on the other side, here comes Paul later, and he wants to divinize Jesus. And so you have two tracks, Paul, the culprit, the pure tradition of Jesus' family, and the corrupt tradition of Paul. Another one of the key themes in that book is that possibly, and he's careful to say could be, but he spends so much time on it, you get the idea, he thinks this, that Jesus has a father, and it's not Joseph. It's a man named Pantera, who is a Roman soldier and an acquaintance of Mary. Who knows? Was this a rape? Was it a willing thing? He says, I don't know. We don't know how to put this in there. But he tracks a Pantera, a Roman soldier, up to Germany and says, we have his gravestone here, and kind of tracks him back to Sidon. in the Middle East and says, hey, you know what? When Jesus goes to Sidon, and it says that it was he wanted to be quiet about this, guess what? Maybe he was going to see his father. So this whole father tradition, the Pantera thing, which, by the way, seems to me a very tenuous mixture of archaeological, here's a tomb with words, could be this, could be that, could be this city, and then it almost becomes, you know, he doesn't say this, but it almost becomes a could be, later it becomes a, well, sort of is, not quite, but sort of, but you're left with this, Jesus' father's name's Pantera, and when he visits Sidon, he's going to see his father. You know, so it's this kind of secret theme.
Let's talk about Jesus' death and his resurrection. What's the evidence from the traditional view that basically is going against this?
I think the most troubling thing about the death of Jesus in the Tabor book, now you said, he's very clear that Jesus died on the cross and death by crucifixion, you don't get away from this, and we're sure. And he's right in mainline theology with that kind of conclusion. Virtually no one raises questions about that today. But his point, he takes a theme that is almost never voiced in 200 years of theology, and the idea is the pre-crucifixion Jesus has such an exciting, magnetic personality and is so good at rallying the troops. And then, of course, what he adds is he passes the baton, and so that when he dies, throws himself on the wheel, so to speak, in Schweitzerian fashion, reviving that theme of Schweitzer, to whom I believe the book is dedicated, to the memory of Albert Schweitzer, as he throws himself on this wheel, almost as if to force God's hand to bring in the kingdom, not in a political sense, but in a religious sense, and thereby overthrowing the Romans, it's an alluring kind of tale until you find out that somehow you need to get these guys past some pretty heavy despair, depression, despondency on what's called Holy Saturday, because if he's their best friend, they've been following him for years. He's the one indeed who they kind of secretly hope is going to overthrow the Romans and put them on the right and left side in key positions. And then in the Gospels, he says several times, I'm going to die. And they're like, yeah, right, you're going to die. We're here, you know, we're your bodyguards. And all of a sudden, he does die. What's this for me and my family and my kids and the kingdom and the... Psychologically, I mean, leave out the Gospels if you want to. Psychologically, you can't explain this without kind of hitting rock bottom. And Mary, who moves the body, is going to rally the troops. She's the one who knows where the body is, but she's going to rally the troops. If you want a technical footnote here, Rudolf Pesch made a thesis like this in the early 70s, and he said the pre-crucifixion Jesus gives us enough impetus to explain the history of the church. And he was jumped on. It's a huge discussion in the German literature. And Stuhlmacher and Hengel and some really big names jump all over him. And Pesch sort of repents and changes his theory and says, you guys are right. You cannot have the church without a resurrection. And he postulates appearances. I think that's what's missing in the Tabor thesis. Now, I should add, he thinks Paul, he does postulate Paul's spiritual appearance. But Paul's like the guy who comes lately and who confuses Christianity.
All right, we're going to hit that a little bit more. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to keep talking about Da Vinci Code is coming. We want to comment on a few things there. We also have Michael Bajan's book, The Jesus Papers, and you were in that special, Craig, and we'll talk about that. We also have Bart Ehrman's book, Misquoting Jesus, which attacks the traditional view of the Bible in terms of inspiration and inerrancy from a textual critic's point of view. You're the expert on that, so we're going to take a look at that in a moment. Stick with us. We'll be right back. All right, we're back. We're talking about some of these best-selling books that are also on television specials across the country, and NBC and ABC and National Geographic. And here's one that Craig Evans participated as one of the expert scholars. It's called The Jesus Papers. And it's put out by Michael Bajan, the same fellow that wrote Holy Blood, Holy Grail. And that theme was taken over into the Da Vinci Code. And so his deal here is that Jesus didn't die on the cross. He was drugged and then he was a traveler. And Craig, tell me about this one.
Well, I find Bajan's latest book, The Jesus Papers, absolutely breathtaking in naivete and gullibility, and I don't know how else to put it. We are asked to believe that on the basis of Bajan's seeing two letters written in Aramaic, a language that Bajan cannot read, two letters which were shown to him by a murky, mysterious figure who collects antiquities, and supposedly found these two letters, papyrus letters, buried beneath a house in Jerusalem. We are asked to believe that these letters actually were written by Jesus some years after he supposedly died. And so Bajan wants us to believe that this is proof that Jesus did not die on the cross, but in fact had perpetrated a fraud with the help of Pontius Pilate. So this gets even better.
Right.
And now has deceived his disciples, and they think he's alive, and so goes the rumor. Maybe Jesus died and was resurrected and so forth, and you have Christianity growing out of what is, in essence, a fraud. Well, I can't think of anything more ridiculous. Who else has seen these letters? How can two pieces of papyrus survive buried beneath a house in Jerusalem? A lot of people don't understand that. They think, well, the Holy Land, don't we find old documents there all the time? No, you find documents in the arid, very dry, warm climate of the Dead Sea, or you find documents buried in the dry sands of Egypt. You do not find 2,000-year-old documents buried under homes in Jerusalem, which gets rainfall every year. This story is unbelievable. On what basis should anyone take Michael Bajan's claims seriously? Earlier we talked about the Gospel of Judas. That's a real document. It really does exist. It did circulate in the 2nd and 3rd centuries. Irenaeus talks about it. It's a real document that doesn't tell us any real history, but it's a real document.
Right.
These papers that Michael Bajan is talking about, they're not even real.
Yep, and we're going to talk about it more because he hooks that up to some of the theories spun by the Da Vinci Code and saying that when Jesus didn't die on the cross, he actually kind of escaped, went down to Egypt with Pilate's help. And, of course, that kind of formed the basis of what the Gnostics were actually writing 2nd century. His teachings kind of filtered down there. And then, of course, he escaped up to France, and that's the royal line that's up there. Well, it all falls in if there's no proof. And he's got no proof. He's got no evidence on that. And he's asking you to believe a pig in a poke here in the sense that he says, I've seen it, but I can't read the language, but trust me, here's what it says.
Sure, and he's got supporting documents also that he hasn't seen, which rumor has it were bought off by the Vatican. This is bogus scholarship. This isn't scholarship at all. This is just sensationalism, and I have to view it with the gravest misgivings.
All right. This is one of your buddies, Bart Ehrman. Misquoting Jesus. You went to school with him? Was it Princeton?
We overlapped at Princeton one year. I was a visiting fellow, and he had just finished his PhD there at Princeton.
All right. He takes another tack. He's got a lot of stuff on the Gnostic Gospels and diversity of Christian groups in the 2nd century and so on, but this is more of his own personal story. He went to Moody Bible Institute, went to Wheaton College, then he went to Princeton, studied under Bruce Metzger. He was an evangelical Christian. And along the way, he started to doubt his own ideas about the Bible. And he says, one of those is the fact is, if you believe in inerrancy, you got to have a perfect script. And you have to have a perfect script, and we don't have it. We've got 25,000-plus manuscripts that have different little twists in them. And he says, that's a problem. We can't get back to what the original script was.
I'm very troubled, and frankly, I'm baffled by Bart's view there. I don't understand what the problem is. Everybody who goes to seminary, he would have learned this at Moody Bible Institute, and he certainly would have learned it at Wheaton long before going to Princeton and studying with Bruce Metzger. Of course there are manuscript errors. There weren't printing presses in antiquity. These manuscripts, biblical manuscripts, were handwritten. There are always mistakes that are made, and sometimes they are intentional. But as you said, we have thousands of manuscripts. We compare them. The Greek New Testament that we have extracted from these manuscripts, we are confident we have 99%+ of the original form of the text. So this whole problem about scribal errors or textual corruptions, as a cause of the collapse of his faith. I don't see it. I find it completely unnecessary. The Bible is very well preserved. There's no question that we have Jesus' message. There's no question that we have Paul's letters. 99.9%. And there is no doctrine of any significance impacted by these scribal errors. And I have a real problem with misquoting Jesus for that reason.
Yeah, I just give you an illustration. I remember studying the classics, and you had Catullus, the poet. And the fact is that there's only two manuscripts that have survived, and there are 1,000 years in between where we've got nothing. Okay? There's no classical scholar I know that says what we have in Catullus isn't what he actually wrote. Okay? But let's say that you for the people that are listening, I want you to recognize, if we gave a class of 40 kids who got A students, B students, C students, and my friends in that class, okay, and you gave them the Gettysburg Address and said, copy this, and it was perfect, and they copied it, and then you took the perfect ones, you just threw them away, and you said, okay, we're going to try to get back to that perfect one with these 40 kids. Now, if you had two kids, and they were D students, you might have a real challenge. But if you got 40, they don't all make mistakes in the same spot. And so when you compare the documents, you can say, well, you know, if 38 kids had the word in there and two don't, we'll keep it in there. And this is how textual criticism comes down. You want more manuscripts. If you got 25,000 versus two for Catullus, okay, the fact is we can get back to what is pretty close to that perfect manuscript. Now, there's other things, and we're going to talk about those. Gary, we got one more. Da Vinci Code. You've been lecturing on this. This is coming out. It's like a tidal wave coming over us. Give me something about this that bothers you.
Dan Brown says that the deity of Christ, so many other things, were A, stolen from other ancient mystery religions, and B, Constantine becomes the anti-hero here, or the hero, depending on your view. But he invents everything. The comment in there by one of the professors that Jesus was a mortal man, nothing more, until Nicaea in 325. Nobody thought he was any more. We can't get any earlier than that. No more claims. The New Testament. Constantine chose the New Testament books. He shoved the ones in he wanted. He just wholesale. He burned the rest of them. More than 80 Gospels were told. Just some rather non-factual claims as opposed to that fact page right there at the beginning after the title.
Yeah, because the truth is, the Gnostic text that he's talking about, that he says has the real story, they got more of a divine Jesus than a human Jesus. And the New Testament actually is a human and divine all the way through all of the writers in the New Testament.
Yeah, and the Gnostic Gospels are not the friends of, he wants Jesus, he says Jesus is the first feminist. Well, you've got Thomas 1:14 that says Mary can become a man so that she can enter the kingdom. I mean, this isn't the friend of feminism.
Yeah. All right. We're going to continue this in our next program, and we're going to go back through these books again because we want to look at the death of Jesus Christ. Pilate is completely different in each one of these books and what he does. And we want to look at the resurrection. You've got lots to share with us, so please join us next week. Welcome to the program. If you're breathing out there and you've been watching television, you know there's all kinds of specials that have been taking place about Jesus. And you know that the Da Vinci Code movie is coming down the pike May 19th. Here are two that are connected. The Jesus Papers by Michael Bajan is the latest one. Remember, he wrote Holy Blood, Holy Grail. And Dan Brown copied Holy Blood, Holy Grail, some of the thoughts about that book in the Da Vinci Code. Well, now Bajan came out with a new one called The Jesus Papers. And one of my guests, Dr. Craig Evans, was on that television special on NBC. And my other guest here is Dr. Gary Habermas. He's chairman of the Department of Philosophy and Theology at Liberty University. Now, Craig, let's start with you. You were on this special, okay? And the Jesus Papers says he's exposing the greatest cover-up in history. Jesus didn't die on the cross. He was drugged, da-da-da-da-da. And he went down to Egypt, and then later on up to France. He's got a real tale going on. What's wrong with this?
Well, just about everything is wrong with that book, imaginable. In the Dateline program, Michael Bajan said to Sarah James, the interviewer, that the gospel story of Jesus' death is a fraud. Well, the only fraud that we're talking about here is Michael Bajan and his book. This book is it's a travesty. There is no scholarship in it. He bases his conclusions on documents either he hasn't seen but are rumored to have been bought off and hidden away by the Vatican, or the most ridiculous part, two letters, he says, written in Aramaic, which he has seen but can't read, and no one else has seen, supposedly letters found underneath a house in Jerusalem 40 years ago, which any papyrologist would tell you is impossible. Those letters would have rotted away a long time ago. We are asked to believe on the basis of these letters, which he says Jesus wrote long after he supposedly died. We are supposed to believe Bajan's interpretation that Jesus really didn't die, that somehow in cahoots with Pontius Pilate, with his knowledge, Jesus was drugged, faked his death, and was taken down, put in the tomb, and then at night, according to a piece of artwork, when the moon is up, Jesus' body is taken out of the tomb where he's later revived. This thing reads like a real cheap detective story. It is ridiculous.
I wonder if he believes any of it himself. I mean, he's a smart person, but what he's telling you, nobody would buy a house or swap land in Florida on what he's saying.
Well, they shouldn't. They'd be very foolish if they did.
Yeah. One of the things, Gary, is right down your pipe, that this whole thing, the historical basis for Jesus' death and the resurrection appearances. Bajan says, and it's copied over in a lot of ways in things in the Da Vinci Code, but one of the things that Bajan says is he was drugged. Now we're going back to what is called the old swoon theory. And it's very interesting to me that smart scholars like Elaine Pagels at Princeton kind of said, we need to investigate that all over again. This is Hugh Schoenfield's Passover plot, the swoon theory. This has been dead for a long time, that theory all by itself. Why in the world is that resurrecting itself right now, and let's knock it dead again?
Well, it's the old idea of what goes around comes around. The swoon or apparent death theory was the most popular critique of the resurrection of Jesus prior to about 1830. And in 1835, David Strauss wrote A Famous Life of Jesus, in which he critiques this view. His major critique was, the problem with apparent death is that no one who's struggling, who survives the tomb, should have died on the cross, didn't. Should have died in the tomb, didn't. Can't roll the stone away, dead. Now, Strauss didn't accept the guard, but he walks on feet pierced by nails to where the disciples are, and he holds his hands up, and he says, I told you I would rise again from the dead. And what's he look like? He hasn't washed his hair. He's bleeding again. He's bleeding through his clothes. He's limping badly. And the phrase that comes from Strauss, the disciples would get a doctor rather than proclaim him risen. In other words, here's what comes out of the apparent death theory. Alive? Yes. Risen? No way. There's a lot of difference. People don't make that distinction. Alive? Yes. Risen? No. Because you have two problems. First of all, the man you see in front of you is not raised from the dead. And Peter maybe is shouting out, go get a doctor, get some rags, get some water. They know he's in bad shape. And then you've got one of the disciples over in the corner. Almost 20 times in the New Testament, we are told that believers will be raised like Jesus. You've got a disciple over there saying, oh boy, someday I'm going to have a resurrection body just like this one. The problem is the theory doesn't work. It doesn't translate from that kind of life to eternal life. And therefore, the church is without cause.
Yeah, then you have to come back and say, where in the world did they get the message of resurrection if Jesus was in a bloody form and later on he must have crawled into the bushes and died or something?
Well, I don't doubt. The critics are right. They would say, wow, God spared him. Yes, they would say that. Could they see an answer to prayer? Yeah, if he survived the cross, I'd say, this is a miracle. But you don't go from that to resurrection. Alive is not raised. Look at Lazarus. He dies again, right? These other people die again. So alive is not raised. Somehow you have to make that gap. And I will say this. With all the other critiques of apparent death that are around today, medical ideas and other things, Strauss's critique still reigns true. I just did a count recently of what scholars say. First of all, you can count guys on one hand. Of the 2,400 sources since 1975 on the resurrection, French, German, English, this many. I mean, not five, but I mean on one hand, you can count those who think apparent death. When scholars respond, they still cite Strauss. I think all of us would like to have that kind of influence in our writings, but Strauss's critique has been around for almost 200 years is the knockdown critique of the apparent death theory.
And Craig, let's follow up on that. In the terms of resurrection for Jewish people, what was it?
Well, there would be a heavy burden of proof to make the claim that Jesus was resurrected. And I mean a heavy burden of proof in the thinking of Jesus' followers. They don't expect him to be resurrected right away. Someday in the future in the general resurrection, of course. But two or three days later, no. They're not expecting that. And if a wounded Jesus came staggering into their company, they would react exactly as Gary just said. They would call for a doctor. They would call for 911. They wouldn't say, our Lord is risen. That would never occur to anyone. And some try to say, well, maybe Jesus wasn't really resurrected. Maybe it was just a series of visions that some of the disciples had. Maybe it's more like a ghost story. That is condescension, I think. That is belittling the intelligence of these people. They know the difference between a ghost story and a person who's resurrected. They know the difference between a revived, wounded man and resurrection. There had to be something about Jesus when he appeared to them that convinced them, despite their expectations, Jesus was truly resurrected, and that it isn't just somebody's vision or a rumored ghost story. There had to be something very real, and I would add, tangible, to convince them that Jesus was indeed resurrected.
I went and talked with Tom Wright at Westminster Abbey, who was the canon theologian there, and he also appeared on ABC's Jesus special when Peter Jennings was alive, and he was talking about the resurrection. Now, ABC cut out his words, but we had him say those words later on. He said the reason he became a Christian, he was a professor at Oxford University, the reason he became a Christian is because of the resurrection, okay? And he painted a scene that was unbelievable. Gary, you were a skeptic. You're going to Michigan State. You didn't even believe this. And then you had ended up doing your PhD in this area. What was riveting about the resurrection that nailed you?
I think what is most convincing about the resurrection data is that without virtually any exceptions, scholarship thinks you have a dead Jesus. Bajent is odd man out in this discussion. You have a dead Jesus. What you have to account for is what is conceded by virtually everybody, because you have to have a cause for their turnaround, for their radical turnaround. And what being willing to die means. We often miss this point. Being willing to die for what you proclaim. We have a lot of people in the world today who are willing to die for an ideology, political or religious. But what that means is, when you're willing to die, you believe your cause. So now you have to back up and say, why do they believe this cause? And I think the single most important event after the death of Jesus is that his earliest followers, and not just the Paul tradition, but the James, the women at the tomb, both traditions, what we have here is an experience. I'm going to say this the way critics will all affirm, is that the earliest followers of Jesus had experiences which they believed were appearances of the risen Jesus. And that single statement, that they believed they saw the risen Jesus, the data comes like this. There's at least 10 different lines of data from early reconstruction of this, arguing that they thought they saw the risen Jesus. And natural theories don't explain that away. You have to at least concede they thought. And I think that's the key, because they had experiences. And going back to why we're transformed today, we're easily transformed today by somebody else's ideology. And all I require to die is to be really sold out. The disciples were in a unique place. They were really sold out to an ideology, but they are the only ones who were present for these experiences that gave rise to the ideologies. They died for, I'd say it this way, they died for the truth or falsity of an event, not for the truth or falsity of an ideology. The ideology comes later. And to me, that's the key early proclamation on which Christianity is based.
All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue talking about some of these books. We've got The Jesus Dynasty by James Tabor and The Gospel of Judas. What do these have to say about the death and resurrection of Jesus? We also want to talk about what's the difference between a spiritual body and a physical body, and what was Paul talking about, and did he have just a vision? Those kinds of questions when we come right back. All right, we're back. We're talking about, did Jesus actually die on the cross, or is Michael Bagent right? It's the greatest cover-up in history. He actually got off that cross and survived, went down to Egypt, and then over to France. And the fact is, we've got also the Gospel of Judas. And these things, Craig, put them in perspective for us. What are these things?
Well, as I see it, Dan Brown's book or Michael Bagent's latest book, this is mostly fiction with just a few facts sprinkled in. And you know what? That's what the Gospel of Judas is. And the Gospel of Judas is one among many in the second, third centuries and beyond. You take a couple of facts and you spin a yarn, you spin a fanciful tale, and you say, hey, folks, in private, behind closed doors, this is what Jesus really taught. But that has not a shred of claim, legitimate claim, to what Jesus really did teach in public.
Gary, let's talk about Jesus actually did die on the cross. All the evidence is there. You even have non-Christian sources, which you wrote a book, The Historical Jesus. You got all the non-Christian sources in here. All of them say Jesus died. And Tabor in the Jesus Dynasty, he says, you know, it's almost incredible that anybody would say that he didn't die. I mean, that's a sure fact. But let's get Jesus dead here. How do we know for sure Jesus died? And then what about these resurrection appearances? And did Paul just have a vision?
Well, that's a tall order. Some of the relevant facts here are medical. And unfortunately, we know crucifixion from more than the first century. Reported crucifixions during the Nazi persecution of Jews. There are several medical doctors who've asked for male volunteers to be crucified, and they've observed what's happened. One with a radiologist who watched what happened during the chest. There are different views on exactly what happens, but the predominant view is still, and Michael Bagent reports this, interestingly enough, that the predominant view is that death by crucifixion is essentially death by asphyxiation. If you hang with your arms out, the weight of your body pulling down, the closer your arms are to your head, the faster it's over. In one experiment in Germany a number of years ago, the men passed out at a maximum of 11 minutes. Now, that's too soon for historic crucifixion, but that's because the men were hanging from 2x4s and their feet were not attached to anything. What attaching feet does is actually prolong it, because as long as you can push up and you can free your lungs, the predominant view again, you can breathe, but gravity, pain, because you're pushing up on the nails in the case of many of these. By the way, almost every ancient reference to crucifixion mentions nails, not ropes. That doesn't mean people couldn't have been tied, but almost everyone mentioned nails. So you're going to push up on nails. I think it's kind of built in here. Very painful, anti-gravity. You can't stay up there very long. You slump back down, you begin asphyxiating. You don't have to have a medical degree if you're standing there to make sure the person's dead. All you have to do is, how long has he been in the low position of the cross? Because the low position of the cross is designed to ensure death. Then you have this detail in the Gospel of John that they stabbed Jesus in the side and blood and water came out. The leading medical view is that the spear went through the heart, as indicated by the fact that the water comes from the pericardium, a thin sac that surrounds the heart that holds a watery fluid in the blood from where it's held in the heart. It's not true, by the way, that dead men do not bleed. Now, some New Testament critics have said, that's a spiritual mention here by John. We don't find anywhere else. I'll just mention there are two references outside the New Testament to people having their chest pierced. Martin Hingle's little book on crucifixion mentions several sorts of coup de grace, a crushed skull, a bow and arrow to finish a guy off. Broken ankles are for that reason, so the person can't push back up. Recently, James D.G. Dunn, in his book Remembering Jesus, said that he takes very seriously the references outside the Gospels to the piercing, just to make sure the job's done. Makes sense. So you've got the asphyxiation, you've got the chest wound. We already mentioned the Strauss critique. This isn't the kind of person, the person who comes out of this is a person who's alive, but that kind of person is not raised from the dead. So these are just a few of the reasons, but today it is virtually unanimous among scholars. And besides, if he didn't die on the cross, you've got to get James on board. How does Paul come on board later from a, you know, raised Jesus and walk around?
Because all through the New Testament Gospels, you have the family of Jesus didn't believe in him. I mean, the brothers, James and Jude.
Mark 3, John 7.
They didn't believe in him. And the only thing that seemed to have turned them around is what 1 Corinthians 15 says, is he appeared to James. Well, that would do it, wouldn't it?
It would. that would, and yet you have Tabor saying that that tradition, that vision tradition, doesn't go through Jesus' family, if I understand him correctly. So, yeah, a lot of claims contrary to it. And I keep saying over and over again what the majority of scholars grants today. Almost nobody takes apparent death. But I should say, this isn't established because almost everybody concedes it. It's the other way around. Almost everybody concedes it because we have multiply attested facts that come in from different angles. You only concede, I mean, a good scholar concedes what the data says. So the fact that the data says it is far more important than scholars concede it. But when you get both, I think we're onto something pretty heavy historical fact.
All right, talk about the empty tomb, because Tabor says there were two graves, and everybody's got a version on this. Of course, Bajan says he didn't die at all, so he escaped and went down to Egypt and then over to France. And I'm just saying, talk about the actual data in the New Testament that shows he was buried.
Yeah, and Craig's done a lot of things on this too, on the burial, but I recently counted virtually everything in print on the resurrection, French, German, English. And what came out of this is 23 different arguments for the empty tomb cited by recent New Testament scholarship. This is an amazing number of arguments. By far, the most common one is that women report this. And the idea is, if you're going to make up a story in the first century, and by the way, it's not true, what you often hear, women could not testify. They could testify, but oftentimes there's an inverse relationship between how important the data are and whether you use women. The more important it is, you don't use women. Now, if you're making up a story, you don't use witnesses on this important fact where the audience is going to say, used women. Why does each of the Gospels cite women? Because women were the ones that went to the tomb. Now, that has impressed a generation of scholars. But you also have what I call Jerusalem factor. If you're going to make Jesus raised from the dead, put the tomb in Turkey. Put it somewhere else. Not in the city where the church is born, where a Sunday stroll could determine whether the grave is open or closed. You also have enemy attestation. You also have multiple attestation on the empty tomb. They do, contrary to a few New Testament scholars, the New Testament empty tomb texts are not dependent on Mark. We have three or four independent attestations here to the empty tomb. This is heavy stuff. And, you know, one of the favorite comebacks of the critics, some of the more further left critics, I'll say, well, hey, your own source tells you that they didn't preach the gospel for 50 days. Come on. After 50 days, you'd not recognize the body. I say, wait a minute. Whoa, 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 whoa. This is a moot point. The gospels did not proclaim, we have a tomb with an unidentifiable body. And since it's unidentifiable, it's not Jesus. No, their claim only works if there's no body in the tomb. And anybody could, confirm that with a Sunday afternoon stroll in Jerusalem. So don't put it in Jerusalem, and don't use women. The exact two rules they disagree with, plus multiple attestation, plus enemy. We're on the road to a good factor. And by the way, the vast majority of New Testament scholars, about 75%, if you count them, about 75% concede the empty tomb.
All right, we got a hold up there. We got 1 minute left. Craig, what hits you with what Gary was saying here? Summarize what we've talked about today.
The Jewish people took burial very seriously. So any idea that a person still alive put in a tomb, or a person not buried at all, or the idea that somebody lost track of Jesus' body or it went missing, all of that is condescension, and frankly, it is insulting to the Jewish people. They took burial traditions very seriously. The Gospels rightly note the women noted where Jesus was buried. Why? Because eventually his body would be moved to a family tomb when the law allowed it. Remember, Jesus died the death of a criminal. And so his burial was not in the hands of his family, but his family could keep track of his body, at the very least, a year later, gather his bones, place them in an ossuary, and put the ossuary in the family tomb. We have to keep the facts in mind when we interpret the Gospels.
All right. In our next program, I want to talk about some of the hype and the buzz that surrounds these books, but I also want to talk about one thing that they're all sure about, and that is Jesus never claimed that he was God. All right, and we want to talk about where he did claim that. Also, that Son of Man statement that keeps coming up and came up at his trial. We want to talk about Pilate. And was he in cahoots with Jesus? Or everybody seems to disagree with the New Testament view of how Pilate is presented. We think that it's right on target, and we got a lot of evidence to support that. So all that we're going to talk about in our next program. Welcome to our program. We're talking with two of the best, and Dr. Craig Evans from Acadia Divinity College and Dr. Gary Habermas from Liberty University. We're talking about the Gospel of Judas. We're talking about the Da Vinci Code. We're talking about the Jesus Dynasty. We're talking about misquoting Jesus and a few other things here. These are books that have been made into specials on television that you've probably seen. They kind of coincide with the coming out of the Da Vinci Code. And there's one theme, guys, that all of these books agree on, and that is, if you look at the New Testament, Jesus never claimed he was deity. He wasn't God. Da Vinci Code says that was invented later on. And the others just seem to say that he didn't have that kind of a vision for himself, that he was this or that. And I would like to talk about the evidence of where you see that Jesus did claim that he was God. Craig, start us off.
The evidence, I think, is seen very clearly in Jesus' reference to himself as the Son of Man, understood in terms of Daniel 7. And combined with Psalm 110, he says that as Son of Man, who received from God authority and power and the kingdom, he will sit at God's right hand. And the reason I know that that is a claim to his own divinity is because that very passage is talked about rabbis later, and they consider it blasphemous for anyone who appears to be a human to say that he will sit at God's right hand. That is outrageous.
All right, now
Jesus does.
Now you're talking right down the Jesus dynasty, and this is mentioning something that came up in Tabor's book, and so keep on going.
Well, what was it about Jesus' teaching and his activities that some people found so offensive? Well, of course, there were disputes over the Sabbath and things like that, Jesus' association with sinners. But what we begin to see in that context is Jesus assumes the authority to forgive sins. Who can forgive sins but God alone, people wonder. Well, as Son of Man, Jesus wants to demonstrate that on earth he has authority to forgive sins. Why does he say that? Son of Man on earth? He's talking about the Son of Man in heaven in Daniel 7, who received from the divine throne authority and kingdom. That's an astonishing claim. And then before Caiaphas the high priest, he says, you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand coming in the clouds. And you know what's interesting about that? Some critics have said, oh, how can you be seated, which implies being stationary, and yet coming with the clouds, which implies movement? And naturally, some scholars think, well, we must have two divergent traditions clumsily juxtaposed. No, we don't. We are talking about God's throne, which is actually part of a chariot. That's the description in Daniel 7. That's the breathtaking element here. Jesus is saying to Caiaphas, the next time you see me, I will be seated at God's right hand in his chariot throne, thundering through the clouds of heaven, coming in judgment on God's enemies. And you will be numbered among those enemies. And that's why Caiaphas was outraged and tore his robes and cried out blasphemy.
Let's put this on the screen so people can see. In Mark chapter 14, which everybody says is one of the earliest accounts, we read Jesus is on trial before the Sanhedrin. The high priest asked him, are you the Christ, the Messiah, the Son of the Blessed One, it's the Son of God? Jesus said, I am. And you will see, here's the Son of Man coming up, the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven. The high priest tore his clothes. Why do we need any more witnesses? You have heard the blasphemy. What do you think? They all condemned him as worthy of death. Now, hook that up with the verse that he was quoting from in Daniel, okay, that the Sanhedrin knew by heart, okay, and here it is. Daniel says, in my vision that night I looked, and there before me was one like a Son of Man coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days, that's God, and was led into his presence. He was given authority, glory, sovereign power. All peoples, nations, and men of every language worshipped him. His dominion is not just an earthly dynasty. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away, and his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed. So this is the data that we find in the New Testament documents and in the Old Testament scriptures. This is what you're talking about that's at stake here, and you're saying?
That's why Paul says God was in Christ reconciling the world. That's why in the fourth gospel, Jesus says, "He who has seen me has seen the Father." All of these traditions go back to Jesus' breathtaking claim that he is the divine Son of Man described in Daniel 7. And that was not lost on Caiaphas. In other words, it was very well understood by his critics, and he was condemned to death for it.
Gary, you've got some other spots in the New Testament that are multiply attested to that talk about Jesus being God.
Yes, first of all, Craig's got some of the best work out here on Mark 14, and I think Son of Man, Son of God, two titles that really, really deserve attention to get it back to Jesus. But I would make the claim that we don't wait decades to see the deed of Jesus. This is not an evolved doctrine. In fact, I would make the statement, might sound a little stunning to some, but I would say that if we use only the pre-Christian hymns, confessions, creeds, the embeddedness, these embedded statements, dozens of them in the New Testament, if we use only those comments, with the possible exception of John, possibly including John, that deserves some discussion, but arguably the highest or nearly the highest Christology can be taken from these embedded sayings alone. So if you go back to the earliest statements about Jesus, I'm talking about what do we do with a text like Romans 10:9, when just a few verses later, it's clear that Lord, in that context, confess with your mouth that Jesus is Lord and believe in your heart that God's raised him from the dead. And just 10:13, the Lord is Jehovah, Yahweh, from the Old Testament. And so it's pretty clear what Paul's saying here, but that's not Paul. It's a pre-Pauline confession. Romans 1, 3, and 4, where the names Lord, Son of God, and Messiah are used in context, and we're told that he gave proof of all these things. He gave witness of all these things by being raised from the dead. I'm thinking you have to do something with Philippians chapter 2. The two bookend verses, Philippians 2, 6, with the in the form, the morphe of God, balanced with 2:11, every knee shall bow, every tongue confess, which of course comes from the book of Isaiah, where the same language is not only used of Yahweh, but he says, I will not share my glory with another. And this is attributed to Jesus. And even that Johannine prologue in the first 18 verses, what you do with that, bookend verses, I would suggest like the bookend verses in Philippians chapter 2. You've got the Word was God, and 1:18, the only in the better manuscripts, the only begotten God in the bosom of the Father. See, bookends in John 1, bookends in Philippians 2, Romans 1, Romans 10. You have those early Acts sermon portions where Jesus is given very lofty titles. And I think we have this combination of what Jesus said about himself and what the earliest church said. Some New Testament scholars move these things, these Acts comments even, to the 30s A.D., 1 Corinthians 15, to before Paul's conversion. These are early, early attestations. So when people say, and their implication is almost always there, well, after decades, they copied off the mystery religions, and they began to realize he was a god. First of all, you go to Jesus, and then it's there in the earliest embedded comments that are taken from the early preaching and later recorded in the pages of the New Testament.
Yeah, Craig, let's talk about the fact that these documents, let's say we were non-Christians, okay? If you're a history major, if you're looking at ancient documents, sources rule. Earliest ones basically win, okay? Now, what's happening today in these specials, the ones that we watched that you were on, and also the ones that are coming out and so on, the thing is these specials are taking the Gnostic writings of 200 years after Christ, and they're trying to get parts of it back as close to the apostles' writing as they can. And then they're taking the New Testament documents. You got nine sources. You got Matthew, you got Mark, you got Luke, you got John, you got Paul. You got Jude, you got Peter, and the writer of Hebrews, and who am I leaving out? One more. The fact is these sources, nine sources that are all written before, say, the first century is over, okay? In fact, tell us about these sources and how you would date them and why they are our best sources, and if you're a non-Christian just listening to this conversation, that you go to these sources for your information about Jesus and why it's accurate information.
Oh, I quite agree, John. There's a, you might even call it a stealth scholarship at work. And I found it so frustrating in my involvement in the National Geographic program that investigated the Gospel of Judas. Now, I think National Geographic did a great job, and they were very fair to me. But what I noticed in some of the other participants was this tendency to take what clearly are second century, if not later, sources and sneak them into an earlier period to try to get the Gospel of Thomas and the Gospel of Mary, maybe even the Gospel of Judas also, and smuggle those later documents as close to the end of the first century as possible, and then you will hear them in reference to the New Testament Gospels and other New Testament writings doing just the opposite, pushing them further away as close to the end of the first century, maybe in some cases even into the beginning of the second century, so that they can then speak very loosely of early Christian writings or early Christianity. And then that is the backdrop to comments like diversity in early Christianity, as if to say the diversity, which is clearly attested in these second century documents, as if all that is going on at about the same time. And so when Mark writes his gospel, or Matthew writes his gospel, or when Paul writes his letters, it's all sort of happening in the same generation. And we've got this great big diversity, and it just so happens one stream, one out. But is it any better than the other streams? Oh, who knows? And that's the part about it that I find frustrating. And frankly, it's not critical discipline scholarship. It's something else.
All right, we're going to take a break when we come back. Let's push Paul back to almost the time of Jesus in 1 Corinthians 15, and I want you to show us how it's done, and we need to tell people what the evidence is. We'll talk about that when we come right back. All right, we're back. We're talking about some of the most popular books that are out today, that specials are being done on television, including the Da Vinci Code and the Jesus Dynasty, the Judas Papers and Jesus Papers and Misquoting Jesus. These books, there's something that we as Christians look at these books and we say, you know, we got a hard time. Talk to me about why 1 Corinthians 15, which is Paul's account, goes back almost to Jesus himself.
Right. What we have in Paul, and you mentioned in the last segment, when you're doing historiography, probably no principles are more important than early testimony and authoritative testimony. People who are in the right time and the right place to report what they report. And 1 Corinthians 15 is arguably, I would say, the central text in present discussions on these subjects. And the reason is this. If we start with the cross at approximately 30 AD, if we call that ground zero, and before the Gospels, before the earliest Gospel, 1 Corinthians checks in at about 55 AD, plus or minus, whether conservative, whatever the writer, conservative, not conservative, we have 25 years. Now, I'll just stop right there and I'd say, in ancient historiography, this is incredible. In a time when the best-known biography of Alexander the Great, that of Plutarch, is almost 400 years after Plutarch, when we learn from the early Caesars, from Tacitus and Suetonius, and a good gap is 100 years, 25 is incredible. From a person, Paul, which you're going to look hard to find a critic who says that who doesn't admit that Paul believed he saw the risen Jesus. And here you have him writing this account and giving a report, which he says in 1 Corinthians 15:3, I'm passing on to you as of first importance that which I also received. Well, wait a minute. If the cross is ground zero and 1 Corinthians 15 is a mere 25 years later, Paul said in the first two verses of that chapter, he's writing it here, but he said, I proclaimed this to you when I came. When did he go to Corinth? A few years earlier, perhaps 51. Now we're plus 21, but here's the key. Paul said, I gave you what I was given. And being an apostle, we have to at least give Paul credit, having done rabbinic research, at least he believes that these came from good sources. Well, in fact, contemporary scholarship, almost everyone who answers this question believes that Paul received this material, Galatians 1:18, they believe that Paul received this material when he went to Jerusalem about 5 years after the cross. Some put it as early as 3, like Gerrit Ludemann, and as late as 8. That's the range. So average of about 5 years. And Paul does the math for you. Here's the cross. If he comes to Christ in his trip to Damascus, perhaps at plus 2, 3 years later, he's in Jerusalem, 2 plus 3. Some might move it up or back. But he's in Jerusalem. He's with Peter and James. He spends 15 days with them. I love C.H. Dodd's comment. They spent 15 days together, and it's safe to say that they did more than talk about the weather. In the context before and after, they're talking about the gospel. So, I mean, what else do they talk about? Paul said, I preach nothing but Christ and Him crucified, but that is the context in Galatians 1, both before that comment and beginning in Galatians 2. So he's there with Peter and James, and then he comes back in Galatians chapter 2. He makes a second trip to Jerusalem, and I think 2:2, Galatians 2:2 is one of the most incredible verses in the entire New Testament. I set before them the gospel that I was preaching to see if I was running in vain. Now, vain, I mean, you know, check out 1 Corinthians 15 on what vain is. And he's going to subject his gospel to James, Peter, and now John is there. The biggest foursome in the early church, the most influential writers, Chuck Tabor, the most influential men in the early church, they're there together. And Galatians 2:6, they added nothing to me. Galatians 2:9-10, where we get our little phrase, they gave us the right hand of fellowship. Now, if we can trust Paul, and Paul's the darling of critical scholarship, Paul lays before them the gospel, they added nothing to me, and they confirmed our message. Who? James, Peter, and John. Wait a minute. I thought we had a divergent tradition here, the James tradition, the Paul tradition. That runs roughshod over Galatians 1 and Galatians 2, unanimously ascribed to Paul at about 50 A.D., perhaps. One more thing. If he gets this in 50 A.D., I'm sorry, 35 A.D., that's simply when Paul received the material. If he got it from James and Peter, they had it before him. So you have Gerrit Ludemann saying that this material dates from perhaps 3 years after the cross. You have the Jesus Seminar in their Acts of Jesus book saying by their vote that this Pauline material probably preceded Paul's conversion. So now you have it in that little tiny opening between the cross and Paul. And of late, one of the most influential, if not the most influential theologian right now, James D.G. Dunn, said in his recent book, Remembering Jesus, that this passage, 1 Corinthians 15:3 and following, wasn't just taught, it was already stratified. It was already put into this creedal form within months of the crucifixion, says Dunn. Now, we know Jesus dies in the spring. Within months, this is a 30 A.D. report, according to James Dunn. You know, if you're going to talk about second century things, talk about second century things. But I want to know how we're going to beat 30 to 35 A.D.
Yeah, so now you've got this report that goes right back to Jesus himself. And, I mean, that from 150 years later for people talking about Jesus is like us talking about people before Abraham Lincoln, for Pete's sake. That's a long period of time. And to say that the people 150 years after Christ have got the scoop, and Paul and James and Peter do not. And, again, these fellows are testifying to what Paul says there. The reason that's a creedal statement is because that language that Paul uses in 1 Corinthians, he doesn't use some of those words in other places. So it's the scholars can see that. Talk to me about that.
Well, that's very important. We look for these kind of embedded nuggets for early tradition that predates the writer. Tradition that the writer appeals to because it's common ground. Keep that in mind. Paul has a problem with what some Christians at Corinth are saying about the resurrection. So he appeals to not just common ground, but ground that precedes Paul himself and his theological developments and reflections. And so this is very important pre-Pauline common ground. And he tells the Corinthians, be reminded of this and keep in mind what this is teaching. That I agree with Gary, that is very significant. It's very old, very primitive. And to overthrow that with traditions that developed 100, 150 years later, I find that a very, very dubious way to proceed.
John, if I could just jump in here for a second. I think I don't want to be misunderstood as saying two things here. Not only is this material early, an eyewitness. Everyone says, at least for Paul, it's eyewitness. Then we have Paul's comments about three other eyewitnesses. So at least we have Paul's comment on them. But the other thing is the Tabor response that there's two early traditions, and James does not agree with Paul, I just want to say the same material that says this is early says there are not two traditions. Now, somebody might say, well, wait a minute, didn't Paul and Peter have an argument? Yes, they did. It's Galatians 2, second half of the same chapter. But it's over a periphery item. It's over fellowship with Gentiles. They do not discuss the sinner. They're in agreement there. They added nothing to me, Galatians 2:6. They gave us the right hand of fellowship, Galatians 2:9 and 10. The earliest leaders are together on this. And to overthrow that is going to be very difficult in light of the authorship of Galatians, Paul being behind it, and Paul being, you know, a rabbinic source, a good thinking mind who gives us his name and place on this. It's a solid line of evidence.
Yeah, Craig, for the non-Christian that is listening to this, what we're saying is, look, if you're a non-Christian, these are solid sources that you've got to deal with. And summarize what the conclusion is when you actually come to this and give it a fair shake.
When you get right down to it, when you boil it down to its simplest terms, Paul himself knew eyewitnesses of Jesus' ministry and resurrection. Paul himself was encountered and changed by the risen Christ. I would take Paul's testimony any day over the fanciful and hypothetical reconstructions of some of these modern writers.
All right. Next program, we're going to take that 1 Corinthians 15 passage and let's talk about the eyewitnesses reported they saw Jesus. What does that mean? Was it a vision? Was it an actual physical appearance? How do we know what the difference is? And we'll talk about that in our next program.
We invite you to join us today to find out the truth about these new controversial books.
Welcome to our program. We're talking with two of the best, and Dr. Craig Evans from Acadia Divinity College and Dr. Gary Habermas from Liberty University. All right, we're talking about some of the most controversial books that are out and TV specials that are being made about them, and then the Da Vinci Code movie that's coming up. And there's some common themes that seem to be running through them about Jesus. Jesus is at the top of these topics, all right? Here you have Jesus didn't die on the cross, and here he did die on the cross, but the fact is his dynasty lives on through James. And then, of course, you've got the Da Vinci Code. And I want to follow up, guys, on something that pertains to these books, but that we left the folks with last time. And that is that you were talking about Paul's account in 1 Corinthians 15 about what happened at the beginning of Christianity, why Christianity spread. It had to do with the resurrection. It had to do with the fact of who he was in agreement with, who the eyewitnesses were. And then we need to talk about the kind of appearances that Jesus made to these men. So rehash that for the people that weren't with us. The fact is we're talking about Jesus comes to the end of his life. He dies, put into a grave. Then stuff happens. Okay, Paul recounts that, and why is it important what he says in 1 Corinthians 15?
Well, it's our earliest extended account, for one thing. And the point I made was it's a mere 25 years after the cross, 30-ish A.D., 55-ish A.D.
His book is written, Corinthians is written...
1 Corinthians, about 55 A.D.,
right.
Mid-50s. But Paul first gave this to them orally, he says, first two verses. So we got about a 20, 21-year gap there. But the key is... And in 15:3, Paul said, I delivered unto you of first importance that which I also received. And the critical scholars who answer this question put Paul's reception of this back at Jerusalem. Now, some put it in Damascus, which, by the way, moves it back a couple years. But the most common answer is that he received this in Jerusalem from Peter and James at about plus 5. Paul's conversion plus 3 years later up to this trip. And in the context, both before and after, he's discussing the gospel. And at the first visit, by the way, the Greek term there, hystereisai, is often said to be a term of investigating data, sort of the investigative reporter.
Galatians chapter 1 is where he recounts his little trip up there, and this is where you find this word.
118. And so he's playing sort of the investigative reporter, according to several word studies, and he's interviewing, as it were, Peter and James. I assume asking, is your experience like my experience? Because Paul was solid on his. But then a few verses later, James 2:2, he goes back up there to make sure that the gospel he was preaching was true. And in Galatians 2:6, he said, these persons, and now John is there, John, Peter, James, the brother of Jesus, he said, they added nothing to me. And then John, and then in same three, John, Peter, James, in Galatians 2:9 and 10, give the men there Paul and Barnabas, the right hand of fellowship. So there's an agreement. So I was drawing the conclusion, even critical scholars will say, that's when he received the creed. It predates him because these men had it before Paul had it. And the Jesus Seminar says it predates Paul's conversion. Garrett Ludeman dates it at maximum 3 years after the cross. James D.G. Dunn puts it in 30 A.D. So this is very, Gerald Collins, by the way, also moves a number of these back to 30 A.D., he says.
Let me interrupt early. You. What I'm saying is that creed. Before we talk about what's in that creed, the fact is the background of the characters that we're talking about. Why did Paul become a Christian? Because he was persecuting Christians to start with. What converted James? Why did he convert to Christianity when the fact is he was against his own brother all of the time when Jesus lived? Okay? You got a stubborn brother. Okay, you got Peter that denied Christ and he's depressed after the crucifixion. Okay, these guys all say something happened to them and it's recorded in this creedal passage here. Keep going.
Yeah, of the big four there in Galatians 2, only John does not have egg on his face. The other big three, critics freely admit that James is an unbeliever before he admits the reason Jesus, at least at some point earlier in Jesus' ministry. You have Peter who denies him, Paul who goes after Christians, and they're all on board because of the resurrection. So at the core, on the gospel, that's what Paul lays before them, both in Galatians 1 and in Galatians 2, there's agreement. So there's not two strands in the early church. I'm sure there's periphery things in which they agree. Second half of Galatians 2, there's an argument. Barnabas and Paul, there's an argument. But in the central proclamation, deity, death, resurrection of Jesus, the earliest strand of Christianity agrees. People would like to say there's another strand there, but it's not our fault if everybody in the earliest strands agrees.
All right, Craig, let me pick it up with you here. The fact is that it's not just the fact of the resurrection, but the fact is Jesus actually appeared to these guys. Okay? Now, what that word appear means, and the word vision means, and sightings of Jesus, these books all have different interpretations of what that means. From the scholar's point of view, tell me what it means to you.
Well, the word appear can mean a lot of things, but what I find compelling is that the various people who saw Jesus, whether they believed in him, or were indifferent toward him, or in fact, like Saul of Tarsus, opposed him. They interpreted the appearance in terms of resurrection. And I think that's very important. And in my view, that rules out the idea of a ghostly apparition or some kind of a dream vision. And of course, it rules out what I think is a nonsensical idea, a staggering, wounded Jesus wandering around looking for his friends and looking for medical help.
Okay, Gary, how many resurrection appearances were there? You read these guys, and it's either one or a couple, or, you know, you get the idea it's very slim pickings here, but the fact is there's a lot more resurrection appearances than these guys are giving credit to.
Yeah. New Testament scholars today don't try to come up with a specific number, but of the ones we're told, they're somewhere in the neighborhood of 10 or 12. Interestingly enough, the earliest account, Tabor tries to make a deal of the fact that the earliest gospel didn't have any appearances. Now, that's in itself. Critical scholars agree that Mark knows the appearances. That's clear from a number of reasons we can state if you like. But what I like to say here is they will note progression of legend, and they'll say, look at Mark, no appearances. Look at John, two full chapters. I want to say, what about Paul? The longest list of resurrection appearances comes from the pre-Pauline creed, 1 Corinthians.
Give them to us.
The list from Paul?
Right.
Well, in the list of Paul, you have three groups and you have three individuals. He appears to Peter, he appears to James. Last of all, Paul says he adds to the creed or creeds. He says, last of all, he appears to me. The groups, you have the 12, all the apostles, and 500 at once, of whom the greater amount remain alive. And most commentators think Paul's point there is to say, go on down to Galilee and interview them if you want to. Going down there. So Paul's got that, a list of six, and now you've got to put that before Mark. So the fact that Mark knows of appearances but doesn't list them, Tabor says something like this. They go to the tomb, they see an angel, and the angel says, breaking off at verse 8, they find it open, and the women walk away astonished, talk to nobody, and he says, period. He says, that's all you got, Mark.
Yeah, so he's saying Mark had no resurrection appearances, didn't know about any.
Well, see, much of New Testament scholarship will end Mark at 16:8, maybe probably even a majority view. Craig can address that. But I think what New Testament scholars say is Mark, by nature, shortest gospel, likes to leave hints, the messianic secret and so on, likes you to unpack things. There are three indications that Mark knows of resurrection appearances.
What are they? What are they?
Well, first of all, he predicts. He has Jesus predict his dying and rising. Mark 8, Mark 9, Mark 10, Mark 14, going to Galilee. So he predicts it. Would Mark put an appearance there, predictions by the Lord, and then say, golly, he died and remained in the tomb? That's a prediction of appearance because he knows of appearances. Secondly, Tabor, interestingly, does not mention this. The angel says, he's not here. He was dead. He's alive. Go to Galilee and you will see him. Can't miss that point. Proclamation of resurrection. This third one's a little more hinty, but critical scholars find in the reference, go tell the disciples and Peter that he's raised. That might be the Petrine priority tradition that we see in 1 Corinthians 15, 3 and following, and Luke 24, 34. Luke 24, 34 is a very important little creedal, one of those embedded creedal statements. He's raised indeed and has appeared to Peter. They see that's for sure in Luke 24, for sure in 1 Corinthians 15, and it may be in Mark, go tell the disciples, and Peter. So two for sure, prediction, angelic proclamation, possibly Peter. Mark does know their appearance.
What about Tabor's idea that the fact is that the lists differ? I mean, is there something that's valuable here about everybody's got to do it the same way? I mean, you know, if all the four Gospels had it exactly in order, they would have said, hey, that's a copy job here, okay? They aren't independent witnesses. Now that you have independent witnesses, I mean, now you're damned if you do and damned if you don't.
Yeah. Two things to say about that. First of all, I think the list in Paul corresponds to more things in the Gospels than we think. Those who say, like some of our references here, the list hardly correspond at all. And some critical scholars say they don't correspond. Wait a minute. You've got the lead appearance to Peter. Luke 24, 34 has that early creedal soundbite that he appeared to Peter. And maybe the Markan allusion there. So you got Peter. You definitely have an appearance to disciples, to the 12, and to all the apostles. Where to put the 500? Okay, maybe we don't have a parallel there. Maybe we don't have a parallel to James. If we take Acts as volume 2 of Luke, which I believe it's Tabor that takes that as volume 2.
Sure.
You have the appearances, the threefold appearance to Paul, which is corresponds to the last of all, he appears to me. So the list is fairly clear. But I think second thing I'd say is, I think critical principles here are lacking. The same critical principles that these fellows apply in the other works. And it goes like this. The difference between Paul and John is about 40 years. Every writer preserves traditions from their community. And the fact that over 40 years, different communities, the fact that different communities report different stories is what you'd expect. Nobody has to give an exhaustive list. That's not the way the New Testament works.
All right. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about one more thing on resurrection. That is, what does the word spiritual mean when Paul uses that in 1 Corinthians 15? Because these guys use it against Paul, and we'll talk about that when we come right back. All right, we're back. We're talking with two of my favorite guests. We're talking about the Jesus Papers by Michael Bajan. We're talking about the Jesus Dynasty by James Tabor. We're talking about the Da Vinci Code. We're talking about the Gospel of Judas. Craig Evans has been on a couple of these specials that you've seen nationwide. And Gary Habermas is an expert on the resurrection. And Gary, let's follow up with you in terms of, we got one more thing. Some of these writers in these books will use Paul's words in 1 Corinthians against him in the sense of, what was the Jesus that who is the Jesus that he saw? Was it a real physical Jesus? What kind of body did he have? Was this a vision? Was it a ghost? The words are spiritual body and physical body. Does that mean when he says that Jesus had a spiritual body, we're going to have a spiritual body, but the fact is we won't have a body, we're going to have some kind of a ghostly body? What do those words mean in the Greek?
Well, first of all, the tables have turned in just recent years. For the last few generations, I should say decades, the typical view has been that spiritual body is sort of a disembodied, albeit real, appearance. I would just say in passing, even on that old view, that older view, Hans Grass, Reginald Fuller, people like that, even on the old view, Jesus really appears. So I think it's very, very important that the key fact is he appears. Now we're discussing the kind of body, but with these guys, resurrection is there. But now the recent trend is to see anastasis and agero and words like that as being bodily in nature. Now, people point to Tom Wright's book, his 2003 book, The Resurrection of the Son of God, where Wright argues that these terms across the spectrum in every source, he argues every source. He might be pushing that a little bit, but he says basically every time the word is used, up until 200 AD, post-Christian, that these terms are used by pagans, Jews, and Christians alike to be an embodied existence. And as Craig said earlier, they knew, they saw ghosts, they knew of spirits, they knew of that. That's not the problem. The problem is they didn't use this word to describe that experience. So when Paul uses soma, and even sarx, flesh, when he uses soma, body, Paul's talking about a bodily appearance, and Tom writes all over that. But the point I want to make is Tom's book is the most detailed. 500 out of 700 pages argues this, that no matter who you're talking about, pagan, Jew, Christian, they all say the same thing. But I would argue that about 10 years before Tom Wright, 15 years before Tom Wright, the table's already turned. I did a count recently of people who've written from about 1990 to date, and about 75% of scholars today say that resurrection or something like it occurred. 75%. Of that 75% who say it occurred, 75 of the 75, in other words, 3-1, say it was a bodily appearance. Ted Peters had a book that was published by Erdmans a few years ago when 20 out of 20 scholars in his book that he edited said bodily resurrection. So I think we're coming to a time where we're noticing that. I'll tell Sable quickly, the higher critical community, and a lot of these guys are good critical scholars. Higher critical doesn't automatically mean horrible. But some of the critics who do not acknowledge this still acknowledge the meaning of the word anastasis. Garrett Ludeman says the key term here is that it's language of sight and that it's embodied sight. That's a key. And most recently, Jonathan Reed and John Dominic Crossan have both said they agree with Tom Wright. And Don Crossan said in his 2003 article, he said, I had already been going there by the time Tom said this. And he juxtaposes Paul's visionary appearance in Acts with Paul's words in 1 Corinthians 15, he and Jonathan Reed in their book on the search for Paul. And they say, we're going to bracket the Lucan explanation as not being firsthand. Paul's is firsthand. He's an eyewitness, and so we're going to say these appearances were believed by Paul to be bodily. I think we've reached a new stage in this argument, and it's a language argument, and Craig's excellent on that. So
push this thing in, Craig. I mean, you've said it a couple of times that the Jewish conception of resurrection, okay, didn't call for this ghostly kind of thing. It had to do with the body. The body, if it had wounds on it, had to come out of the grave with the wounds with it. Okay?
That's right. For Easter to be interpreted as resurrection, it had to be a bodily resurrection and not merely a phantom or something like that. And what Paul is trying to explain in 1 Corinthians 15 when he describes the resurrection body as a spiritual body is he's not trying to deny the bodiliness of it. What he's trying to explain is that it's not a mortal body. It's not a body like the body we currently have. It's not a body that's subject to corruption. And so he calls it a spiritual body to show that it's special, it's immortal, it's imperishable, it is a new creation. That's his point. He's not trying to say that, well, actually what I'm talking about is sort of a ghostly or a transparent body. And some people have misunderstood the point he's trying to make there.
Some of these books say that the Christians swiped this whole concept of resurrection from the mystery religions. Okay, the dying and rising of the gods there. Hit that one.
Well, just a disjunct here. Virtually no scholars will make that move. They'll say, oh, little things here and there, but no one takes this theory wholesale. But if you go on some of the non-Christian websites, the real radical ones, it's all over those websites. But you go to the critical scholars, they don't go there. Why? Because while there are pre-Christian religions, Isis and Osiris predates Christianity. While there are pre-Christian resurrections, we have no, at present, we have no knowledge of a pre-Christian resurrection in those stories. In other words, the earliest resurrection account we have is Adonis, and the manuscripts are 2nd century A.D. Next best shot we have is Attis, 3rd century A.D. They're post-Christian. Now, somebody might say, well, beg to differ with you. You already said Isis and Osiris is pre-Christian. There's a resurrection there. No. And you know what? What's interesting here, Helmut Kester, who's part of this, the Gnostic
at Harvard,
he says, in his two-volume work on New Testament introduction, he says it's good to keep in mind that no text ever says that Osiris was resurrected. So, plus we have to plug that into this discussion of what resurrection means. Talk spirit, talk Scrooge seeing the ghost, talk that. People believe those things happened in the ancient world, but they didn't use the word Gnosticus. So there's no parallel for people to say, oh, they copied off Jesus. In fact, the most recent book on this by a Scandinavian scholar on the recent state of this says, anybody who says that there's a pre-Christian resurrection is a maverick among recent critical scholars. The book was just released.
All right. Go personal on me, okay? Two personal things in your life. Wrap up this program. Let's get it down. The rubber hits the road, okay? You were a skeptic going to Michigan State, and the facts brought you to faith in Jesus Christ. Then you experienced this whole thing of the resurrection in the dying of your wife, okay? Explain what I was talking about. Put it in your own words here. Tell the folks, share with them what you found out.
Well, when I was going through this period of doubting, I debated Christians. I got them pretty angry. And my mother called me at one point during this and said, how are you coming with your doubts? And I said, I think I'm a few months away from converting to Buddhism. And, she wasn't real thrilled. But, and here's what I thought. My conclusion at that time was, you can believe resurrection. There's even some pretty good data for resurrection, but you can't close the door on it. There's too many other options to say the resurrection is what happened. I did my doctoral dissertation on the resurrection, and I kind of used that as the ending period, symbolically, of my questions. But then many years later, I finished my PhD in 76. Almost to the year, 20 years later, my wife was diagnosed with cancer. I thought to myself, great, probably my doubts are going to come back. I'm going to fight two battles. And they never did. And I'm really thankful to the Lord for that. But during the time with my wife, I realized how personal resurrection faith could be. I had these discussions with the Lord. She's upstairs. She's sleeping 18 hours a day. I had a child monitor up there, and I went and sat out on the porch, and my kids were in school. And, Lord, why? Debbie's 43 years old, and I've got four children. What's going on here? And I picture kind of a Job 38 kind of why, and God says to me, well, did I raise my son from the dead? Lord, I've done 13 books on this topic of the resurrection alone. I'm going to be true to my books. Yeah. But can we talk about Debbie? Gary. If you were to ask me a question, right? Gary, did I raise my son from the dead? To make a long story short, I realized that what God would say to me is, if this is a world in which Jesus was raised from the dead in 30-ish A.D., this is a world in which Jesus has been raised from the dead no matter what year it is. And it's 1995. It doesn't change the fact that he's been raised from the dead. As a card I received in those days said, it said, can you wait for that day when hand in hand you'll be able to walk with your wife down the paths of heaven? To me, that's the New Testament teaching of resurrection. Almost 20 times we are told that believers will be raised like Jesus. Paul said he'll take our vile body and make a likeness of his glorious body. That's the resurrection hope, eternal life with the God of the universe.
Next week, we're going to continue this conversation, and we want to hit this area. Was Jesus married to Mary Magdalene? Okay, and I can't think of any two guys I'd rather ask that question to, because you've read all these documents, and we're going to talk about that. And did Constantine, did he actually invent the deity of Jesus Christ in 325 of the Council of Nicaea, like the Da Vinci Code says? We'll hit those two questions next week. I hope you'll join us. Welcome to our program. We're talking with two of the best, and Dr. Craig Evans from Acadia Divinity College and Dr. Gary Habermas from Liberty University. We're talking about five books that are hitting the bookstores all across our country, and one of them being the Da Vinci Code, and you've seen the title already on the other books. But I want to talk about this book this week in relationship to a couple of key topics that you're just going to have to know about. You may not want to know about it, but you're going to have to know these questions. Did Jesus have sexual relations with Mary Magdalene, and did they have a child? Did the church suppress this secret of Jesus' marriage in order to suppress the truth of who he really was? And Craig, start us off on these things. Let's ask the question this way. Out of all of the writings, Gnostic writings, all of the books at Nag Hammadi and all the other books that have been found, the Egyptian codices and so on, plus all of the church fathers, anything that's in your library, take all of that. How much evidence do you have that Jesus was married to Mary Magdalene?
None. That's the interesting thing about this whole discussion. There isn't anything that really suggests that Jesus was married. And, of course, there would be no reason from the cultural view of the Jewish people that Jesus not be married. So it wouldn't have been a scandal had Jesus been married, had Jesus had a family and children and so on. But there isn't a shred of credible evidence that suggests that he was married. And remember, early Christians were fascinated with details related to Jesus. And that's why in the 2nd, 3rd, 4th centuries and beyond, stories were made up about Jesus as a little boy. What kind of things did he did? Was he a good student? Was he a good athlete? Imagination had no bounds. And yet, nobody had him married. And if Jesus had had a wife, whether it's Mary Magdalene or anyone else, had he had children? There's no way that had been a secret. The earliest church would have known that, in fact, probably would have celebrated that. A wife would have been considered a heroine. She would have been the center of a lot of attention. There's no way it would have been kept a secret. There would have been no reason to keep it a secret. So to answer your question, is there any evidence that Jesus was married or had a lover? The answer is no.
Before we look at the text, the Gnostic text that some point to as possibly a place where it was at, let's keep on that point. The fact is there's plenty of evidence to show that he was single, and that's not bad. In other words, there were Jewish leaders in the Essene community as well as John the Baptist, for Pete's sake. These guys were honored, but they were single. Okay? Jesus was single, but don't we have a list in when Paul's talking about the apostles and so on, where if the other apostles had wives, if he mentions their wives, like Peter's wife and the others, the fact is, wouldn't it have been great? I mean, could he have left out Jesus' wife, Mary Magdalene, if that had actually been the case, and mentioned all the others? I don't think so. So it would be strong evidence, don't you think, that this shows Jesus was single. What else do you think about?
Well, sure. Some of these fiction writers think that all Jewish men were expected to marry. Well, they're mistaken. Sure, most Jewish men did get married and have children, raise families, and so on. But there were categories outlined in Scripture. There were reasons. We do know of actual groups, like the Essenes you mentioned, where the men chose to be single. Jesus himself, in one of his sayings, refers to men who remain single for the sake of the kingdom of God. I'm sure he has himself in mind there. He is one such person who has chosen to remain single to do his work.
Talk about the Gospel of Philip and what you find there. Your friend Elaine Pagels at Princeton talks about this. And a lot of people put their assumptions into this text that's filled with holes where you don't actually have the words. Talk to us about that.
Yes, this is in the Gospel of Philip, where in one place it says, in reference to Mary, Jesus kissed her on, and there's a hole in the text. And of course, there's a joke among scholars. And these holes are called lacunae. And so we often will say, well, the most interesting parts in a fragmentary text are in the lacunae. In other words, the part's not there where the imagination can run wild and we can speculate. Well, we don't know what the text says. Some translations say Jesus kissed her on the lips. But lips is not there. We don't know. He might have kissed her on the end of her nose, kissed her on the forehead, kissed her on the cheek, kissed her on her hand. We don't know. And don't forget, in the Jewish culture of that time, kissing people, as Judas kissed Jesus, is a greeting and shows affection. And it does not at all suggest a romantic relationship.
Talk about the Gospel of Mary Magdalene.
Well, the Gospel of Mary Magdalene, at best, second century fragmentary gospel, has Mary singled out for special revelation and special teaching from Jesus, which she then shares to a very skeptical group of male disciples. But again, to infer from this fragmentary text that Jesus had some kind of a relationship, that Mary was a lover or his wife, goes way beyond the actual evidence.
Why are these guys using the word suppress? The church suppressed this. The church suppressed this. They suppressed the secret of Jesus' marriage in order to keep secret the truth of who he really was. What's going on here?
That's a gratuitous assertion. Our conspiracy theory fiction writers love to throw that around. And so it's a trick, in my view. You've got a theory, but it has no evidence. So how do you explain the lack of evidence? Oh, it's easy. You just say it's been suppressed. And that is special pleading in its worst form.
Gary, pick up here. One of the things that the Da Vinci Code says is the Council of Nicaea in 325 AD, they are the ones that decided, Constantine helped them, and he invented the deity of Jesus. And up until that point, nobody even knew that he was even claiming to be God, let alone that he was saying that he was God, or anything like that. The fact is, that's when it came into being. Talk to me about it.
And until then, he was a mere mortal, I think it's text, yeah. Something like that. Well, on an earlier program, we discussed the planting or placing of the teaching of the deity of Christ inside the Jesus tradition, Son of Man, Son of God. Then the early creedal embeddedness in the Gospels. Earliest passages we have, many dating perhaps to the 30s AD, we have high Christology. He's the Lord, as in the Lord in the Old Testament, Romans 10, in the morphe of God. But every knee will bow. But that's only for Yahweh. You know, you have this in the early creedal passages. Then you have it in the very earliest books. Even James, that Tabor likes as the book and this other tradition. There's a high Christology in James, 1:1, 2:1, key places. It would surely seem that those words mean what they mean elsewhere, and that we have a high Christology throughout the New Testament. Then we have the same high Christology in Clement and Ignatius and Polycarp, who explicitly called Jesus God, Ignatius in particular. And going right on. So now, at every point in this path with Jesus himself, we've predated Nicaea by 3 centuries, not 4 centuries, by the way, as Brown says. He says it's 4 century as afterwards. But we've beaten him to the punch by 300 years. So if you want to say he's a mere mortal, and he's never been proclaimed that, I mean, it's the same thing over and over again. It runs roughshod over the data. It's a novel, so you can say whatever you want. But the pity is that people are quoting these things as if that's the fact. It's almost like it's a way out for people who wanted a way out. But that's not anything to do with the data we have.
Craig, what happened at the Council of Nicaea in 325 AD? Were they inventing the deity of Jesus? And what about, did they decide which books were in and which books were out of the New Testament? And did they suppress all of these Gnostic texts and burn them?
Oh, this is so overstated. At the Council of Nicaea, the bishops that gathered together were trying to define the deity of Jesus. And they wanted to make sure they struck a balance that was in tune with scriptural teaching and what the apostles actually taught and what Jesus himself taught. Because the danger was emphasizing the deity at the expense of the humanity. Or perhaps going in the other direction, de-emphasizing the deity in order to give emphasis to the humanity. And so the theologians that gathered had to weigh the biblical evidence and try to be fair to all the evidence at hand. The idea that the Emperor Constantine stepped in and said, look, this is what I think the teaching ought to be, that's absurd. He did not give a Bible to the church, as Dan Brown's fictional characters incorrectly state, and he did not impose the divinity of Jesus on the council either. That is all bogus.
Absolutely. The fact is, you can read all of the decisions, the 20 decisions that are actually printed in Eusebius, at what happened there, and you won't find either one of those in those decisions that were made. But pick up another one. In the Da Vinci Code, Dan Brown's characters say that there were over 80 Gospels to choose from, and basically all those were discarded in favor of these 4. What about that?
Dan Brown is confused at many points. He exaggerates the number of Gospels, for one thing. He refers to the Nag Hammadi codices, the Gnostic codices, as scrolls, and they are not. And he refers to the Dead Sea Scrolls as books. And he says the Dead Sea Scrolls give us the earliest records of the life of Jesus, and they don't. He has gotten his goofy sources from Michael Bajan's works, and he's even misunderstood some of that. And another program, I likened it to just throwing a lot of junk into a blender, hitting the button, and out comes this gray soup, and out of that he makes a theory. And so he's got his facts, bogus facts, misunderstood, confused, and out of that comes a novel. Nobody should take it seriously.
All right, let's go to the next step, though, and that is the fact is that Walter Bauer in Germany put out a book about early Christianity, and it was picked up by Helmut Koester at Harvard and taught to Lane Pagels at Princeton, and Bart Ehrman has picked this up and others, and that was this, that we've got this kind of different Christianities, okay? Gnosticism is just one of them, and they're kind of all on an equal playing level here, and that eventually the traditional Christians, the powerful ones, beat out all these other guys, and these were suppressed. And now, since Nag Hammadi and so on, we've discovered this, and now these suppressed Christians are now speaking to us, and we need to hear their crying voice. Okay, talk about the theories that are at Harvard and Princeton and Yale that are kind of creeping over into the popular literature and why that's not true.
I think what's going on is a politically correct, egalitarian principle that is cherished in the ivory tower academic community today is being foisted on the first few centuries of the church, so that it's very fashionable to speak of Christianity's divergent voices and say they're all basically equal in value and credibility. I mean, after all, it takes faith, whichever system you decide to go with, they're equally valid and so on. And I think that's where a lot of the problem comes from. What I find credible is the people who know Jesus and pass on his teaching accurately and infer from things he said and did and so on, as Paul does in his letters. And this is where Christian theology comes from. It grows out of the historical person of Jesus and what he really said and did. But what happens is there are other peoples out there that like some parts of that story, and they like other parts of other stories, and they blend it together and come up with a new composite, slightly Christian but mostly not Christian, religious approach. And that's Gnosticism. I, in fact, think that there is no such thing as Christian Gnosticism or Gnostic Christians. If they really do embrace the principles of Gnosticism, there's no way you can call them Christian. And just because they talk about Jesus or incorporate things Jesus said or did into their construct, that doesn't make it Christian. Because what? Why? Real simple. They fracture the Godhead, so you have a good God up above, God of light, and a bad God. That's Yahweh, the God of the Old Testament, who's made this world. How in the world can that be Christian? The world is bad? The human body is bad? That's not Christian thinking. Jesus only pretends to be human, as some Gnostics taught. How's that Christian? Jesus really didn't suffer for human sins. In fact, it isn't his death on the cross that saves anyone. It's knowledge. None of this is Christian. None of this is biblical. And so I think it's misleading to refer to this as Christian Gnosticism or Gnostic Christians. And that adds to this idea that you've got all these Christianities out there, kind of like a buffet. Select one that fits you, and that's okay. It's just as valid as anything else. That is misleading.
Craig was one of the Dream Team experts that was put together by National Geographic to examine the Gospel of Judas. And when we come back, we're going to talk about this some more in terms of if Gnosticism should not be associated with Christianity. Again, we're going to talk about why are the scholars continuing to talk about Gnostic Christianity, and we're going to actually use this as an example of how different Christianity is from Gnosticism. Stick around. We'll be right back. All right, we're back. And if you're alive out there and you're listening, I'll tell you what, the fact is you know about the Da Vinci Code. 40 million people have bought the book already. That means if they shared it with a friend, 80 million people have been initiated into the views of this book. this book talks about these kinds of books as being the real Christianity. This is a Gnostic text, and we've got one of the experts that National Geographic picked out to examine this text. It's an authentic text, and yet this is not true Christianity. And Craig explained what the core beliefs, again, are of Gnosticism, why it's not Christianity, what the core beliefs are of Christianity, and then take us back to Da Vinci, why he's wrong.
Okay, the Gnostic view fractures the Godhead into two gods, a good God above and an evil God that's made the earth. This evil God is none other than the God of the Old Testament. It's Yahweh. And so the world, the created world, is considered irredeemably evil. It can't be saved. It's going to be destroyed. It's going to perish. The human body is part of this evil. In fact, the human body is a prison house that keeps the enlightened spark trapped. And so the idea is to escape this prison house, certainly not redeem it. That's Gnosticism. In fact, it not only has a different God, it has a completely different view of Jesus. It has a completely different set of books that are regarded as authoritative. So if I might take an old saying and change it a bit, if it doesn't look like a duck, if it doesn't quack like a duck, if it doesn't walk like a duck, you know what? It probably isn't a duck. And so I don't think Christian Gnosticism is a meaningful term. If it's truly Gnostic, it isn't Christian. If it's truly Christian, it isn't Gnostic. And I think some of the scholars in the discussion these days are muddying the waters and making it confusing for the public when they hear talk about Gnostic Christianity or all these different kinds of Christianities. If Jesus isn't seen as God's Son, if the true God is not the God of the Old Testament and the Judeo-Christian heritage, then we're talking about something else. It isn't Christianity anymore.
Yeah. Talk about how the canon actually came down to us. Was it invented at Nicaea? How did we recognize that we ought to have Matthew, Mark, Luke, John? How should we have Paul's writings? I mean, why do we have those writings in there, and why don't we have some of the other books in there?
Well, arguably, you know, one of the responses to this is when Brown and others say 80 Gospels, and they were burned. I mean, there's a point at which I want to say, well, look, if the cutoff point is 100 AD, for the sake of discussion, we only have four Gospels at that time, demonstrably. Some want to feed other things in here, but the ones that scholars are sure about, four books. You could almost say the church is very inviting. The church is very gracious because there are differences between Mark and John. They didn't get in there and weed everything out. Say John's a little bit later, a little more theological. Let's throw John out. So let's put everything we have in here. And the books we have are the books they had at that time. Right at the close of 100 AD and just before that date, Clement, 97, Ignatius, 107, Polycarp, 110, if you want to go as far as Papias, 125, some fragments, these folks, in terms of the first three, quote at least the oral tradition, if not the books themselves, about the words of Jesus. They quote the epistles of Paul, and they're familiar with the early papyri because they say Paul's are Paul's, but Papias refers to a couple of the Gospels. So they're familiar with the text. And the Gospels, Acts, and Paul's epistles are accepted immediately. Nobody discusses those books. They're not disputed. They're accepted right away. Now, as time goes on, there's some dispute about some of the other books. I mean, we have to allow that. There's some dispute about some of the later books that are placed generally at the end of the New Testament. But by 180 A.D., we have the Muratorian canon or the Muratorian fragment. Well, even though it's broken off, it's starting to look a lot like our New Testament. So even just right there, that's 145 years before Nicaea. That doesn't sound to me like somebody waited for 145 years. We have Tatian's fourfold gospel from 10 years earlier than Muratorian. It's four. It's not 20. It's four. And they could say, well, that's just people lording it over the other folks. But wait a minute. You go back, like I said, to these four folks real early, only one after 110 A.D., and those are the books they recognize. And by the way, there was no vote on books taken at Nicaea. So that's just a bit there. I think what you see here is a movement that starts tentatively, but right from the beginning, even somewhat tentative, the Gospels, Acts, and the Epistles of Paul are the two bodies, Gospels, Acts, Paul, the two bodies that make it unanimously. We can be happy there's some bickering about other books, because that shows we weren't gullible, we weren't willing to take everything, we want to discuss these things, what's played out in different areas. It's very, very important. So we don't have to look at that as, oh boy, we don't want to talk about those books at the end of the New Testament. That's helpful too. But I would say this, if you just look at those books I mentioned, by far the bulk, in terms of words, chapters, by far the bulk of the New Testament was recognized at the close, right after the close of the first century canon. In fact, you could say this, of the disputed books at the end, there's only two books, Hebrews and Revelation, that are longer than five chapters. My point being that those are the shorter writings. That doesn't mean they're not important, but the bulk's already in. Luke Acts is more than a quarter, bulk-wise. Luke Acts is about 27% of the entire New Testament. So these long, you know, involved books, Paul's epistles, these theological works, they were recognized from the beginning. I think we've got to see that process.
All right, let's wrap this up. And Craig, let's go on the offensive, because we're always playing defense here. All these books have come down, these specials have come down, you got the movie coming out. Let's reverse this. For the person that's a non-Christian, what is the recommendation you would give toward traditional Christianity? Why this, if you actually do all the research, if you do all the study, this comes out as being the truth?
I would urge anyone who's a seeker to do what all scholars do in all other disciplines, and that's go with the earliest stuff that is widely recognized and widely received. Don't specialize in stuff on the fringe that almost nobody took seriously. Unfortunately, that's the infatuation with a lot of this modern semi-scholarship and popular writing.
All right. Next week when we come back, we're going to talk about the fact that were there two messiahs, John the Baptist and Jesus, as one of these authors says. We're going to talk about Pilate. Do we have an accurate historical account of Pilate? Almost all of these writers say that the New Testament got it wrong. It's just not historical what it says about Pilate. So I hope that you'll join us next week. Welcome to our program. We're talking with two of the best, and Dr. Craig Evans from Acadia Divinity College and Dr. Gary Habermas from Liberty University. We're talking about the Gospel of Judas. We're talking about the Da Vinci Code. We're talking about the Jesus Dynasty, which is another specialist coming up on television. And Craig Evans was one of the scholars that was chosen to be on the Dream Team for National Geographic in terms of examining the Gospel of Judas. He's also appeared in the Jesus Papers on Dateline and so on. So, Craig, I want to start with you. There's a couple of questions that are raised here in the Jesus Dynasty that are probably going to come forward as we go along through the summer, and that is this. Number one, there were two messiahs, he says, Jesus and John the Baptist. Okay? And he uses the Bible to suggest that there's evidence for this position. Okay? And again, he sets it up with background from the Dead Sea Scrolls. I want you to comment on the Dead Sea Scrolls and then bring it over into the scriptural realm. Do you think his thesis is correct?
In short, I don't think his thesis is correct. But what Dr. Tabor is talking about is the expectation of an anointed priest who will serve the Lord faithfully and standing right next to him, an anointed king. And that was an ideal held by some of the Old Testament writers, especially the prophets Zechariah and Haggai. I think that does lie behind Qumran's expectation. Now, keep in mind, Qumran, the people we identify with the Essenes, who gathered the scrolls and wrote many of them, they expect that in the end time, God will raise up an anointed king of Israel, a Messiah of Israel, probably of the Davidic line, who will serve the Lord faithfully alongside an anointed high priest, which would probably arise from the Essene community. And that's what they're all about. They're very priestly. So they very much emphasize this. Two anointed persons who will rule over a restored and rejuvenated Israel. Now, Dr. Tabor takes this template and applies it to Jesus and John. The problem I have with that is the evidence for seeing John as this high priest, anointed high priest, I just don't find the evidence for that in the New Testament or in any of the sources that Dr. Tabor brings forward. It's an interesting hypothesis, but the evidence just won't support it.
Gary, what do you think?
Well, I think Tabor's shot at finding this in the Gospels and saying, well, this is the Q passage in Luke 7, Matthew 11. This is the Q passage, and therefore...
What's a Q passage?
cure and sayings of Jesus that are found in Matthew and Luke but are not in Mark. And scholars think that along with the Gospel of Mark, they're the two best of the canonical sources.
Yeah, you're assuming it's another source that the guys used. It was the teachings of Jesus in these just teaching verses, almost like
a sayings document.
Right.
Q. Right. And so he goes and he says, hey, Jesus himself acknowledges this, because doesn't he say in that text, the Luke 7, Matthew 11, that John is the greatest man ever born of a woman? Well, Tabor says, that includes himself. So John's greater than him. Now, that's not the normal understanding of that verse, but let's just give him a shot. I mean, wow, that might be a new angle. But if you look at the Q passage itself, first of all, two disciples come to Jesus. John's in prison. And the two disciples of John ask Jesus the question, are you the Messiah, or should we look for another? John is asking Jesus, are you the Messiah? Now, he could say, well, John was one, Jesus is the other. I don't think that's the implication of the question. It's, are you the man? Are you the man, or are we still looking for another one? That's one thing to note. Are you the Messiah? Second, Jesus doesn't say, go jump in the lake. Don't doubt me. He does miracles, which is sort of like the Mark 2 passage where he says, to show you that I can forgive sin, I'll...
In order for you to know the Son of Man has authority on earth to forgive sins,
right?
Told the man that couldn't walk, get up and walk. And
there he is.
What he was saying is, when you see this happen, you'll know that I did the forgave his sins.
That's right. And once again, Jesus tells the two disciples, hey, go tell John what you see about the lame and the, you know, deaf and the dead are raised. And then this little comment, blessed is he who is not offended because of me. It's like Jesus is almost encouraging John. He's talking to the two disciples, and he says, hey, tell John to hang in there. You know, it's sort of, don't be offended because of me. That's putting Jesus up on the pedestal, not John, because again, we're talking about what's Jesus' view here. Are you the Messiah? And him saying, hey, tell John to hang in there. With whom? With me. But thirdly, there's that difficult passage to be sure, but the question, who's this Elijah that's to come? And Jesus says, John, you're looking at him. See, now remember what Tabor's point is. Jesus' view is that they're at least equals. John may be higher. Looks like he's higher. Wait a minute. John's asking if Jesus is the Messiah. Jesus said, don't be offended because of me. And most of all, Jesus' view seems to be that John is the Elijah. He's the Messiah. He's plainly, from the same text that Tabor uses, plainly has John in a subordinate position to himself.
Excellent. Excellent. Craig, there's something I think is going to come up, and you're the expert that can deal with this, okay? There are burial boxes. There are two that are mentioned, at least, in James Tabor's book. And because of your expertise in both the archaeological area as well as ancient manuscripts and so on, let me ask you about two things. There's a burial box that's inscribed, James, the brother of Jesus, that he thinks he's got. You've got another ossuary, another bone box, that's got, supposedly, Jesus, son of Joseph. Okay? Well, obviously, if you've got the Jesus of the Bible, son of Joseph, in a bone box, Christianity collapses. Okay? Now, there's all kinds of problems with this hypothesis. Share some of those as you see it.
Well, as you know, I've done some research over the years in this whole area of Jewish burial traditions, and a few years ago published a book called Jesus and the Ossuaries. And I do deal with most of these very bone boxes with those inscriptions that you've just mentioned. One of the things I've learned along the way is out of the 1,000 or so ossuaries that we have cataloged, only about 240 of them have inscriptions. Now, when you take into account how many hundreds of thousands of Jewish people lived in the first century, we have the tiniest fraction represented in these ossuaries. Then when you take into account how many men were named Jacob, or James as we bring it into English sometimes, and named Yeshua, or Jesus, and how many are named Joseph, I think you get the point. We have a tiny sampling of this huge population over this period of time. How do we know that the ossuaries that we do have, you know, match certain persons in the New Testament? I don't even, you know, everybody's heard of the Caiaphas ossuary. After doing careful research on the way that inscription is made and vocalized the way it should be pronounced, I have serious doubts that that really is the ossuary of the high priest Caiaphas. I'd like it to be. That would be fun. But, and even apart from all the controversy about the James bone box, and, you know, did the owner tamper with the inscription? Is it perhaps a hoax or whatever? Even apart from all that, if we were to accept the inscription as it stands, James, son of Joseph, brother of Jesus, we have not settled the question of identity. It still could be referring to some other family. So that's my point. I'm not going to develop an hypothesis about who Jesus really was. I'm not going to create a Jesus dynasty out of some bone boxes with some names that happen to be very common names in this period of time. That's very, very thin ice, and I'm not going to skate on it.
Yeah, I mean, a statistical count shows that Joseph is what? The second most used name?
Exactly, and that's the problem. And so I think I appreciate the fact that Dr. Tabor talks about the archaeological evidence. He is certainly better informed about such things than people like Dan Brown or Michael Bajan. So there's a lot of useful, interesting material in his book. I just have a problem with the way he connects the dots. And I think he's creating a picture that ultimately the evidence cannot sustain.
Gary, let's switch hats. One of the theories in his book is there were two tombs of Jesus. All right? And on top of that, he simply said the fact is when Jesus actually passed off the scene, well, you can tell the theory there, but come back to the fact that the ones that kept the movement going were Mary, the mother of Jesus, and the brother James. Now, and under his hypothesis, Jesus is dead. What did they have to keep it going? But talk about the two tombs and then how they kept it going.
Well, two tombs for Jesus. Jesus is buried in a tomb which is empty. The reason it's empty is because Mary and several other women take the body and rebury it, not when there's nothing left but bones, but before that. And so the person who's responsible for the moving, Mary, is the person responsible for, along with her son James, the ones firing up the troops. So Mary knows he's not raised from the dead. They have this early message that's different. I think that's one of the most problematic things in the whole Tabor book is that we have a movement started. We have a non-resurrection movement. Go back to Boltman or farther. What's the New Testament? It's a resurrection book. Now, he's got another sense of two tombs here, too. And I'll say that he mentioned six or eight tombs with the name ossuaries, with the name Jesus on it. So very, very common. Secondly, two ossuaries with Jesus, son of Joseph. So common names, to so say it's this Jesus. And by the way, even Tabor admits, no matter what research we do, we can say authentic ossuary, but we could never say same Jesus, same point Craig made about same James. But the other sense of two tombs, he'll talk about this Talpiot family tomb outside Jerusalem, but he also, in a picture in the book, is standing on a hill, or kind of bent down, on a hill in Galilee, and he says this is the hill identified by a 16th century Jewish mystic is the place where Jesus is buried. He said, I know what you're thinking, this is really, really late, but this could be it. And I'm thinking, oh my, now we're kind of venturing from the factual side back into this kind of fantasy world where people can have visions of some sort in the 16th century, 1500s, and say, I think he's on that hill. And I just think he would have been doing himself a favor if he kept the photograph and those little comments out of the book. But unfortunately, it reveals a little bit about the thinking processes here, and I think there's a little bit too much of guesswork.
All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about one more of these books, and that is Bart Ehrman's book, and he attacks holding the traditional view of the Bible from a textual critic point of view and critical point of view. And then I want to hit that briefly, and then I want to summarize what you think about these five different books. All right, and we'll do that when we come right back. All right, we're back, and we want to have a summation on some of these key books that are being sold across our country, and television specials are being made, and they kind of flow into the Da Vinci Code movie, so it's kind of all one big hodgepodge. But here's a best-selling book that continues to climb by Bart Ehrman. And what strikes you? You know Bart. You've read the book. What bothers you about this book?
Ultimately, it's much ado about nothing. And I find it tragic. If Bart Ehrman has lost his Christian faith because of scribal errors in New Testament manuscripts, I think that is very sad. And I'm very suspicious of that explanation also. He knew this stuff when he was a student at Moody Bible Institute. He knew this stuff at Wheaton. He knew it at Princeton. Everybody who goes to seminary, every pastor who has been trained, they know about that. That book is getting attention it shouldn't get, and I would hope that it doesn't harm anyone's faith or discourage anyone from pursuing the meaning of the Christian gospel.
Yeah, textual criticism, like you said before, the fact that we have a text with all the manuscripts that we've got, we can compare those and come back to a 99 9/10% perfect text.
Sure.
Okay? And then there are some things that have been included in the Bible that if you go back to the earliest documents, they're not there. And if you take out all of those, it won't bother anything that we have in doctrine.
Anything
not
important.
A thing. And Bruce Metzger told him this at Princeton.
He knows that. Bart knows this.
Yeah. So we don't want people to get sidetracked on that. All right. You were one of the key scholars in the world that was picked up to examine the Gospel of Judas. You've appeared in this television specials, National Geographic. What do you want people to walk away with in terms of this book?
I want people to know that, yes, the Codex is genuine. The Codex, the ancient book in which the Gospel of Judas was found. Yeah, the Gospel of Judas existed in the 2nd century in Greek and is talked about Irenaeus, the church father, writing in the year 180. But that's all it is, a 2nd century gospel. There are several others also. It has no claim to the true story of Jesus and Judas and the other disciples at the beginning of the 1st century. Nobody needs to lose any sleep over that book.
This is a fictional account versus the historical accounts you've got in the gospel.
Sure.
All right. Now, the fact is, in these other books, let's just talk about Da Vinci for a moment. What strikes you? What bothers you with all the hype that's going on with Da Vinci? Gary?
What bothers me about a lot of these things is, you know, so often it's the believers, it's the conservatives who are the ones, so-called, who hide facts, always jump on one side. That's the point of misquoting Jesus, right, is that, you know, we don't tell people this. And yet, by the way, I'll just add, every Bible college student, or almost everyone who studies Greek, reads from a red plastic New Testament with a critical apparatus at the bottom with all the major variant readings. They don't even hide that from people in Bible colleges. Anyway, we're supposed to be the ones who, you know, we're the keepers of the facts and all this stuff. Here's the problem. All these extraneous accounts and all these second century and later accounts don't have the data. In my opinion, it's a theory and want of data. And I'm going to make a prediction. I think more of these things are going to come out. I think there's more people who are going to claim, oh, I got data and it might just be first century. I think we'll see more of it. Because to have a politically correct Jesus, you have to have data. And they're not immune to this. They know they don't have the earliest data. They just don't. The stuff with Paul and Galatia and, you know, back to 30 AD. All right, they don't. So what do you have to do? You either have to broaden the line, as Craig said, and take it into the second century and say, oh, these are the same as these, which they're not. Or you have to kind of blur these things. I think my single gripe is the fact that if early authoritative data marks the heart of historiography, first century canonical Christianity has it, and the later Gnostic movement does not have it. That must bother people, but it's not our fault if we're taking the first century documents and that's what they say. So, I guess in summary, if we stuck to the data, you've got orthodoxy. I think that's the short of it.
All right. Here's two more. The Jesus Dynasty and the Jesus Papers. There's one thing we haven't brought up, and that has to do with the historical account that is presented in the New Testament Gospels about Pilate. They both would say the New Testament writers got it wrong. That's a crazy view of Pilate. Yet, we don't think so. Give me some evidence why you think that the account in the New Testament about Pilate and how he conducted the trial and how he related to Jesus and how the writers talked about this, why it's an accurate account.
I think the gospel's portrait of Pontius Pilate is accurate, and I know it's quite fashionable today to say, oh no, what we have here is early Christian apologetic, trying to make Pilate more sympathetic than he really was. But that is not a realistic reading of the gospel's account, and it's not a realistic reading either of Josephus, who says a lot about Pontius Pilate. Both Josephus and Philo, who wrote in the first century, talk about Pilate as being really a bad guy, and scholars uncritically accept these very biased accounts from these two Jewish writers who have an axe to grind, and they use Pilate as a scapegoat. Pilate was governor for at least 11 years, and depending on when he became governor, and there's some chronological dispute, he may have been governor for 16 or 17 years, the longest serving governor in that difficult part of the Roman Empire. You don't serve that long because you're bloodthirsty and you kill people all the time. Some popular writers have made that claim. Oh, Pilate, as I think John Dominic Crossan said, there was only one way to administer as far as Pilate was concerned, that was slaughter. No. Pilate, I think, was a typical politician. He was crafty. He kept himself in office. He did not appoint one single high priest. All the other ones did, not Pilate. And that's because he let the Jewish authorities conduct their own business. And so when he came to Jerusalem for that Passover celebration, he had a problem on his hands. A popular teacher has been seized by the ruling authorities, the Jewish ruling authorities, and they want him dead. And Pilate is thinking, do I want to kill this guy on the eve of Passover and possibly spark unrest, start a riot? I don't know. Just because Jesus has insulted them in the temple precincts, I'm not really sure I want to do this. The Gospels play on that, and they point out to readers around the Roman Empire, you see, this is what's going on, this dynamic. It wasn't real obvious to Pilate that Jesus was a threat. That's what the Gospels are doing. I think that's realistic. Pilate, in the end, decides to put Jesus to death.
Yeah, he couldn't have been a good guy if he said, you're innocent, we'll kill you anyway.
But Michael Bajan's theory that Pilate was in cahoots with Joseph Arimathea and some of these other people and wanted to help fake Jesus' death, that is absolutely absurd.
Yeah, because if they're going to use Josephus on one hand, I mean, Josephus talks about how the Roman emperor disciplined Pilate, and boy, the fourth time, Pilate didn't come back, okay? Now, he went up there and the emperor died, but he never came back to the Palestinian area. So the fact is that he was knowledgeable about the fact that you can't offend the emperor, you can't offend the Jews, so they go behind my back and over my head over to the emperor. You got these accounts from non-Christian sources. So this tension between Pilate and the Jewish high priests and what was happening in that courtyard seems like it's accurately portrayed in the gospel accounts.
I think so. And keep in mind, this is Passover. What is Passover in the Jewish calendar? It's celebrating God's deliverance of his people from Egyptian bondage. So here we have a Roman governor, and people make analogies. We're suffering under now Roman bondage. The last thing the governor wants to do on the eve of the highest and most holy holiday is put to death a popular preacher who's come down for the celebration of Passover. He doesn't want to do that. He's on the horns of a dilemma. And so I think the gospel portrait is very accurate at that point.
One last thing, we've got 1 minute left, and that is the fact you take any of these books, and if you believe them, the fact is you lost the gospel message. Okay? What is the good news that you just dropped if you believe any of these things?
The good news you drop is the earliest presentation from 30 A.D. to 100 A.D., and especially back to the 30s, what the Christians call the Gospel, the New Testament, where the definition is given, you've got the deity of Christ, death, resurrection. You can trace it back to 30 A.D. This might sound strange to a lot of people, but conservatives take a stand on the data we have. We can't dismiss data because of non-data.
Guys, you are terrific. I really appreciate you being here. And folks, what you need to recognize is you do not have to be afraid of the case for Christianity that's made in the New Testament Gospels and the New Testament books. It's solid information. You don't have to believe that your faith is going down the tubes here because of these new assertions made by some scholars. So I hope that this is encouraging to you. And guys, I appreciate you breaking your neck to be here on this program and to share this information with our folks.